7.
I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call.
And I'm KALW News Director Ben Trefney.
And we invite you to join us tonight as we make sense of the results of Election 2016.
Starting at 5 o'clock, we'll bring you NPR's special coverage as polls close on the East Coast.
Then, from 7 to 9 p.m., I'll host a live broadcast from the Roxy Theater in the Mission District with returns from across the country and independent analysis about what the results mean for the White House, Congress, and the future.
At 9 o'clock, we'll bring it back to the KALW studios for live local coverage of what's happening in California and the Bay Area, and we'll be taking your calls about this historic election.
Tune in for a full night of election coverage.
Starting at 5 p.m. here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
The election is finally here. The race for the White House has been defined by Donald Trump and his racist and misogynistic remarks about Mexicans, immigrants, and women. While so many of us are breathing a sigh of relief, it's important to analyze what we've endured over the past year. The media have been obsessed with Donald Trump's hateful comments. It's been ugly to watch. It's been painful to watch. So how are you reflecting back on this election season? And what does the election reveal about the state of our country and the media? And then, how should we move forward? Join us after the news.
Hello, I'm Marion Marshall with the BBC News. Across the United States, long queues of people have been waiting to vote in the US presidential election. After one of the most divisive, unpredictable campaigns in memory, analysts expect turnout to be a key factor in whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton wins the White House. All 50 states and Washington, D.C. will vote across six different time zones. Support for the candidates was mixed at this polling station in Davie in the battleground state of Florida.
There's only one person qualified to be president. I've never gotten a job that I wasn't qualified for.
In my neighborhood, there's a lot of Trump supporters, so who knows? It's up in the air. It's very close. This year.
There's one competitor who's a little bit of an a-hole, so that's kind of how I made my judgment.
Trump, looking to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C.
I think we need change, but Trump is definitely not the answer.
I voted for the person that represented most my values and family values that we have at home. So why is because I believe we need change, and right now we don't have it.
In a surprise announcement, the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has said that high-denomination notes of 500 and 1,000 rupees will no longer be legal tender from midnight local time. With the details, Justin Rowlatt.
This is being described as the boldest attempt to tackle tax evasion of any Indian government in history. But that is probably an understatement. This is one of the boldest moves by any government to tackle the problem of what here in India they call black money. At a stroke, Prime Minister Narendra Modi has declared a large portion of the money in circulation in the world's seventh largest economy worthless. The 1,500 rupee notes are the largest notes in circulation. 1,000 rupees is worth $15.
Five people, suspected of aiding the Islamic State group, have been arrested in coordinated raids in Germany. Among those detained in northern and western Germany was an Iraqi man who's known as Abu Wala. German media described him as a senior Islamist figure. Here's Jenny Hill in Berlin.
Germany's justice minister has described the arrests as an important blow against the extremist scene in Germany. The five men are believed to have formed a jihadist network to recruit and support fighters for IS. They were arrested during early morning raids in Lower Saxony and North Rhine-Westphalia. Among the suspects is an Iraqi preacher known as Abu Wala, who's said to be a senior Islamist figure in the country. The news has been welcomed by the German government, which is trying to reassure a nervous electorate. A few months ago, IS claimed their first terror attacks on German soil.
Officials said that the raids came as a result of information from a 22-year-old jihadist. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. A judge in Hong Kong has sentenced a British banker, Rurik Jutting, to life in prison after he was found guilty of the brutal murder of two young Indonesian women in 2014. Jutting tortured Sumati Ningsi before cutting her throat. 3 days later, he murdered Seneng Mujiasi. Jutting recorded not only Miss Ningsi's horrific ordeal, but his own response to what he'd done.
"My name is Rurik Jutting. About 5 minutes ago, I just killed, murdered, this woman here. These are not the actions of a sane person. These are the actions of someone who really should not be in society."
A damning report has found the Metropolitan Police Force in London guilty of serious failings in its inquiry into an alleged historic paedophile ring among leading public figures and politicians. A retired judge identified dozens of mistakes in the way that the allegations were examined. He said the police had believed that one of the complainants was credible for too long and should not have said publicly that his allegations were true. Sir Peter Fahey is the former Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police and now the Chief Executive of the children's charity ReTrack. He says cases of alleged sex abuse are difficult balancing acts.
"What we know about these sorts of crimes is that they often happen in secret. The abusers put fear into the victims to make sure they don't speak out, and often it's very difficult to find supporting evidence. So what we can't get away from is that these are really difficult cases to actually investigate, and there are huge numbers of victims who are not seeing justice."
Armed men, suspected of belonging to Mozambique's main opposition RENAMU party, have attacked a train in the northern province of Nampula. Police said they shot at the train in the early hours of Tuesday morning. No casualties were reported. RENAMU has been staging sporadic attacks in an effort to force the government to allow it to govern provinces it says it won in elections 2 years ago. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, it's finally Election Day. Millions of Americans are going to the polls today. In fact, so far, nearly 40 million people have already voted. According to a study by the Pew Research Center, the 2016 electorate is the most racially and ethnically diverse ever. 31% of ballots are expected to be cast by ethnic minorities. That's up from 29% in 2012. Latinos have already made history by voting early. They have turned out in very large numbers in Nevada, Florida, and Arizona. According to the New York Times, the number of Latinos who have already voted in Florida matches the number of ballots cast by Latinos in 2012. This election will go down in history as one that has been defined by the politics of fear. Over the past year, the national media, especially the broadcast media, have been obsessed with Donald Trump and his insults against immigrants, refugees, women, and people with disabilities. So as we near the end of this election cycle, how should we evaluate the root causes of what we've been seeing? Now, so many people are saying that they're happy this day is finally here, but it's really important to analyze what we've endured over the past year. It's been ugly to watch. It's been really painful to watch. So what does all of this say about the state of U.S. politics and the media? And what message are you sending with your vote? If you'd like to join us early on in the show, we'd love to hear from you. How are you reflecting back? How are you processing what we have endured over the past year? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by two guests. Eileen Truax is a Los Angeles-based freelance journalist who covers immigration, politics, and the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Eileen is the author of the book Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Her forthcoming book about the exile and asylum process from Mexico to the United States will be published next year. And Eileen Truax joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Very happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Sasha Abramsky. He is a contributor to The Nation magazine, founder of Voices of Poverty, The Narrative of America's Poor, and the author of 7 books, including his most recent, The House of 20,000 Books. And Sasha Abramsky joins us from Davis. Hi, Sasha. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Well, thank you both for joining us. You know, when we were thinking about what we wanted to do on Election Day, we said, you know, we really need to analyze what we've been through over the past year because it's been ugly and really painful for so many people. I mean, to hear these hateful comments being repeated in the media over and over again. Eileen, how are you feeling this morning when you look back at what we've dealt with over the past 8-9 months?
Well, of course, I think I share the feelings of many people. It feels so good to know that it's almost over. But, you know, at some point also, when you look back, this is a very good chance to try to wade in what happened here. And what have we done during the last months as journalists, as a society, and even politicians, even people in the political parties? I don't know if today, if someone looks back, I don't know, maybe in the Democratic or the Republican Party, what would they do different if they had the chance to go back 1 year? I think the first you just mentioned, well, we had an ugly and painful process. I think from the media, the main thing that I right now to me is catching my attention, and we have to review this in the upcoming weeks to see what would be. It's that from the media, we didn't do our work very well. We allow ourselves to jump in the media circus that was created, especially from the side of the Trump candidacy. And we were not paying much attention in the accountability part, in the fact-checking part. We were repeating a lot of statements that were very hurtful, very dangerous, even in some moments, but we were not going deeper. We have a lot to analyze in that part, the role of social media, the role of, you know, this need to give information immediately and not going in following up processes in our own media to see what happens next after a bad statement or an ugly statement. But at the end of the day, I think much of what has been happening reflects the lack of responsibility that we had in several of our mass media in this country.
And Sasha, what would you add? How are you reflecting today?
Well, I would second what Eileen said, first of all, that it's just good that this incredibly ugly election is over, because I think what we've seen for the last year is a devolution of the political process. And I've been writing on Trump since, I think, December of last year, so for almost a full year. And it's been this extraordinary journey watching one accepted norm after another, not just being marginally damaged, but being absolutely shattered by this demagogue. By somebody who will pit one person against another, one group against another, simply to divide and rule, simply on the scenario that the more friction he can create in society, the more he has a route to political power. And I think for me, one of the true horrors has been the way that the Republican Party went along with it. They got sort of outmaneuvered by him during the primary process. And then when men and women of good conscience should have stood up and said, look, for whatever reasons, our party has done something horrible. We've nominated a demagogue, a dangerous, dangerous human being to a position of power, and we now need to rectify it. Instead of doing that, the Republicans rallied around him. Not all of them. There were exceptions, and Mitt Romney was actually an early one to say, look, I just can't do this. He's dangerous. But a sizable number of the Republican leadership decided they would hold their nose and go with the demagogue. And I think one of the things that it really brought home to me is Trump is a symptom of a much deeper problem in our politics. He didn't come out of the blue. He came out of a situation in which our political system has been paralyzed for the last 8 years. maybe even more than 8 years, probably 20 years at this point. Since the 1990s, you've had Congress doing one thing, you've had the president doing another, you've had this inability to get things done, you've had an economy that works for some but ignores a tremendous part of the population. And all of that frustration and all of that fear and all of that anxiety and all of that rage came together in this year. So when I look back on it 10, 20, 30 years from now, this really for me is going to be an absolute sort of calamity in our body politic, regardless of who wins today. We've just seen this crumbling of civility, and it's going to take years and years and years to repair the damage created by this season, I think.
Yeah, and you remind me of an article in the New York Times, which is basically a timeline looking at all of the racist and sexist things that Donald Trump said. So there are quotes from Donald Trump, and there are the dates at which people decided, Republicans decided to leave Donald Trump.
Yep.
And they stayed with this man for a long time. In fact, so many of them finally left. The breaking point was when he spoke of women, white women, in very vulgar
right.
sexual terms. I mean, it's really telling.
That's right. And, you know, I was at the Nevada caucus, which was, I think, 9 months ago at this point, and I was interviewing Trump supporters about what they thought of Muslims. And one after another, they told me Muslims should either be executed or deported. And I wrote about that for The Nation magazine. And there were other people around the country writing about the kind of hatreds that Trump's campaign was unleashing. And yet somehow people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell decided they could live with all of that bigotry.
Sasha, can you elaborate more on that? What effect do you think that's had on our society? I just got back from Standing Rock in North Dakota last night, and we had to pass through the Minnesota-St. Paul Airport. There's a massive Somali population there. In fact, almost all the workers in the airport are from Somalia. And I met this one woman who's a local, and she said when Donald Trump came to town, he slammed Somalis. And so many people were so angry about that. Now, one woman who was picking up garbage stopped in front of the TV screen with Hillary on the screen, and she was staring at it. And I said, "Excuse me, can I ask you, what are you thinking right now?" And she said, "You know, it's been so painful. We came to this country. We work so hard. We don't make much money, and we work so hard. And yet Donald Trump has just, you know, put us in a trash can, basically. And we really hope this woman wins."
So yeah, I think when you go around the country, you hear these stories all the time, that one immigrant group after another, one ethnic group after another, or one religious group after another has been trashed by Donald Trump in the most personalized terms. And the result is that there's been this acceptabilizing process where people who might have thought racist or bigoted thoughts in private but didn't put them in public now feel they have a license to say anything to anyone. And so you end up with this sort of culture of just vulgarity where people are throwing around racial epithets and religious epithets, and it's just absolutely extraordinary. And you know, you think that in the last few weeks in Trump rallies, crowds have been shouting "execute her, execute her" about Hillary Clinton, and we're supposed to be the greatest democracy in the world, and we have a political candidate who has essentially turned his crowds into mobs. And I think we're going to live with the consequences of this. As I said, this is something that is going to take ages to defuse because he's created something so ugly in our political process.
Eileen, what would you add to that? Specifically, when Trump went to Minnesota, he said that you've got a major problem here with large numbers of Somali refugees coming into your state without your support, some of them joining ISIS, spreading their extremist views. And the local media there, the NPR News, had a piece, "Trump's comments on Somalis draw sharp response." And then, of course, what he's been saying about Mexicans, calling them rapists and criminals. And he said this way back in the beginning of his campaign.
It was in the very beginning of the campaign, and no one in the Republican Party said nothing. But, you know, also, I think, because, you know, it was Mexicans, then it was Muslims, then it was women. I mean, this man having able to say whatever he wants, and he doesn't respond to anyone because no one makes him accountable of this. It has been horrible. I just heard what you guys said, but to me, there's something important here. The fact that Trump was a symptom, that's relevant to me because I don't think it's just Trump, and Trump is appealing this out of the blue. And those people were there just waiting for someone to tell them something to get very angry. People have been angry in this country for many, many years, since the recession, since the crisis. I had the chance to be in some of the Trump events from the beginning of the campaign, and it feels like ages ago. But I had the chance to be in Arizona, to be here in Southern California, in Orange County, and to talk to people who are supporting Trump. And when you talk to them, you know, they don't hate Mexicans. I mean, some of them hate Mexicans, but it's not, you know, the most common thing. People very angry hating Mexicans, or people very angry hating Muslims, people very angry hating people. It's just people very angry because they feel they have been neglected by their own government for a very long time. These are people who lost their jobs in 2008, 2009. Many of them lost their homes. Many of them are not sure if they're going to be able to send their kids to college. Many of them feel that they have gotten nothing from the political class. And now we have this political class trying to tell them, you know, you have to do this, you have to do that, because we are going to do this for you. Mm-hmm. And they have not seen anything like that in the recent years. And then this guy comes, you know, with all the circles that we know, and he starts telling, you know, they cannot give you anything because they have not. And I'm just like you. And, you know, the important thing here is to understand that, yes, I love the phrase that was said before, that Trump turned crowds into mobs. That's true. But that fuel was there from the beginning. And that's a fuel that was directed in a very different way by Bernie Sanders. But it was the same fuel. It was the same feeling among the people that the political parties and the political class is not giving us enough. It's not giving us what we need, and it's not giving us what we deserve. And I think with the Sanders effect and the Trump effect, you can see two different ways this can go when you have people in the streets, in their daily lives, feeling that they don't have options, that they don't have hope anymore. That's the part that we have to look forward once this election passes. And the political parties have to review that. They are not connected with people anymore. And that's the reason why some Trump can come here and do what they have done.
It's so true. Sasha, what would you add to that?
I think that's exactly right. And it's not, I guess the only thing I'd add to it is it's not a phenomenon which is restricted to America. We saw it in England, where I originally come from. We saw it in England a few months ago with the Brexit vote, that when people feel ignored and when people feel that the big international and national political structures aren't responsive to their needs, there's an awful lot of room for anger. And if that anger isn't channeled progressively, the danger is that it gets exploited by demagogues from the right. And so Bernie Sanders was the great story a year ago and should have been the great story of this campaign, that there was this huge number of people who recognized that the status quo wasn't working, and they were turning to very, very progressive political responses. They were turning to Bernie Sanders' ideas on universal health care and on the minimum wage and so on. And we saw that those ideas ended up pushing Hillary Clinton to the left a little bit as the campaign evolved. The real tragedy for me of this election, I've been covering elections for 20, 25 years at this point, and the real tragedy for me here is that there was this radical moment a year ago, and it got completely subsumed by the grotesque circus-like carnival of the Trump campaign. And I think, you know, that's just so sad that you had this moment where people were looking for creative policy responses, and instead this demagogue emerges and hijacks the process for the better part of a year.
Eileen, did you want to jump in there?
No, yes, I totally agree. I totally agree. 1 year ago, we were seeing a movement that in many points recalled the effect that Obama had in 2008, you know, especially with young people. When you have young people that are following politics, feeling that there's a way to do things, and it, you know what was surprising to me when we talk about the Bernie effect, that when I went to several rallies and talked to young people, and they were feeling that Bernie was a guy from out of the system, which is funny because he is a U.S. senator, and I find it hard for a person to be in the U.S. Senate and be out of the system. But the feeling was, this is something different. He's talking to us. He's talking about real issues for us, and he is not afraid to talk about them. But, and Sasha is right in this, in a progressive way, you have to find the right channel. to manage all this anger, all this energy, all this desire to do something, especially from young people. And we got lost. We got lost because we paid so much attention to the Trump effect. To me, I'm sorry if I go back to the media, but to me, we are very responsible on what happened, because when we start fact checking everything that Trump said, it was too late. We really start doing that until the convention, when the guy was virtually the candidate. We didn't do that before. We knew that the emperor had no clothes, and we kept talking about the clothes. That was a huge fail from us.
Eileen Truax is a Los Angeles-based journalist who covers immigration politics and the U.S.-Mexico relationship. She is the author of Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Her forthcoming book about the exile and asylum process from Mexico to the U.S. will be published next year. We're also joined by Sasha Abramsky, a contributor to The Nation, founder of The Voices of Poverty, a narrative of America's poor, and author of 7 books, including his most recent, The House of 20,000 books. And we'd love to hear from you. Today it is Election Day. Millions of Americans are going to the polls today. Latinos have made history by voting early. Really amazing numbers. There's an article in the New York Times about how the number of Latinos who voted early in Florida matches the number of ballots cast by Latinos overall in 2012. So these are huge numbers. Nevada, Florida, and Arizona. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. How are you reflecting back on this election season? The media just keeps saying it's unprecedented. But really, it's been painful. It's been hard to watch. I mean, especially, you know, as a journalist who talks about important issues day after day after day, and then you turn on the radio or sometimes the television, and you just see that there's just, it's so shallow, and there's so much fact-free information out there. In fact, Meet the Press a couple weeks ago, they described Hillary voters as Starbucks coffee drinkers and Trump voters as McDonald's coffee drinkers. I mean, just really flat information. So how are you reflecting on all of this, and how can we move forward? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Eileen, you wrote a book about dreamers. And before we ask you to talk about that book, what are your thoughts about these massive early voting numbers among Latinos in Nevada, Florida, Arizona, and other states?
Well, of course, I'm very happy to hear that, and to see that many media, many analysts are looking at that phenomenon, because, you know, Latinos have been here for a long time, increasing numbers. Of course, it's well known that not always participating in elections, but it's not only the way the Latino community participates going to vote, which is very important, of course, and we are seeing that now. But, you know, it's also that in the recent years, the Latino community has been able to move forward in certain positions, in certain environments, political environments, to have more influence there. And I think we are seeing a reflection on that. I'm going to give you an example. I covered the campaign in 2008. And at that point, we started to talk about dreamers using that particular word. Let's remember that dreamers are those young people who are undocumented in the country, who were brought by their parents when they were minors. Many of them arrived here when they were 2 or 3 years old. They're now 25, 26, and they have no documents, but they have spent their whole lives here. They're, in fact, U.S. Citizens. They're Americans. They only lack a document that says so. So these young people start mobilizing. By 2008, we had social media. We had ways to organize them nationally. And they were very enthusiastic about the candidacy of Barack Obama. So we saw them a lot in many events, in the political rhythm of the campaign. But by that time, the way you would identify a dreamer would be maybe in an event, the candidate or someone else, maybe, I don't know, Michelle Obama, in a university, talking about the struggle of these dreamers and why they deserve to get a regular immigration status and inviting a dreamer to the stage to share their story. And then, you know, a round of applause, and we recognize these people because they're brave and they're strong. Hmm. 8 years later, we are seeing these dreamers as part of the political campaign. You can see Loera Prieli, who is part of the Hillary Clinton team right now, and she's a dreamer. You could see Erika Andiola, who was a communications person for Bernie Sanders, and she is a dreamer. We started in a very short, relatively short span of 8 years, we started seeing these young people, undocumented, coming from being the person on the stage presenting a case to be the person backstage creating the case. And to me, that's a symptom as well. We are seeing Latinos in the arms, we're seeing Latinos voting, we're seeing Latinos being more vocal. And if you attack that community in this particular moment, you're going to have this response.
And Puerto Ricans in Florida are also voting in droves. The PBS NewsHour had a piece about how 7,000 Puerto Ricans are leaving the island every month and moving to Florida. Puerto Ricans will soon surpass Cubans as the largest Latino population in the state. And so what are your thoughts about that, Eileen?
Well, of course, that's another part of the story, because we have in Florida, which is such an important state at this moment, we have that other Latino community with our... recently, I was in a panel, and the name of the panel was With Documents and Without Documents, because we have people coming to the country in different ways, Mexicans, Salvadorians, Hondurans. We know many of them coming with no documents. And then you have the other... kind of people coming to the country, Cubans, Puerto Ricans. I mean, technically Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but you know, they're coming to Florida, to other states with documents. And of course, the experience is different. And because of that, the way they participate in politics is different. But it still has an impact in the electoral results. As we know, traditionally, the Cuban community tends to be more Republican, more conservative. Puerto Ricans tend to be more Democratic, and that changes a little bit the way things play in those states, in that area, of course. It's and that's why sometimes it's so tricky to talk about a whole Latino community, because, yes, the Latinos may have similar electoral patterns, but also they have so many different realities depending on the state where they live, when they came, how they came, and where are they coming from, that you also have to analyze independently these different groups.
Eileen Truax is a Los Angeles-based journalist who covers immigration politics and the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Sasha Abramski is a contributor to The Nation magazine. It is Election Day today. Millions and millions of people are going to the polls, and we are reflecting back. How are you reflecting back on this election? What does this election reveal about the state of our country and the media, and how should we move forward? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. Our phone lines are full, but you can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. When somebody goes away, then a line will be vacated. You can also post a comment or a question at our website, yourcallradio.org. You may tweet us at yourcallradio, or you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. They'll take you to Tijuana, the most busiest international crossing in the world. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are free tonight, we hope you can join us for a live broadcast with independent analysis at the Roxy Theater in the Mission District. It is a free, non-ticketed event from 7 to 9 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. We'd love to see you there. And then after, Ben Trefney will be back in KALW studios. He'll be opening the lines to take your calls from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock tonight. And you can find more information at kalw.org. If you haven't voted yet, make sure you take the time that's needed to fill out the massive, massive ballot. There are a lot of lines. I've already been hearing from people, and that's because we're voting on something like 65 different things this time around. If you still need to do your homework, go to kalw.org. All of our election coverage is there. We also have a very easy one-page sheet that you can print out and then take that to the polling place with you. So I hope that helps you. And then there's also information about places to call if you have any questions. That's kalw.org. And today on Election Day, we are reflecting back on this election. What do you think it reveals about the state of our country and the media? You know, when you think back to everything that we've heard in the election, how are you feeling about all of it, and how do you think we should move forward? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we'll have a phone line open in just a couple minutes. We're joined today by Eileen Truax, a Los Angeles-based journalist who covers immigration. Her book is Dreamers and Immigrant Generations Fight for Their American Dream. Sasha Abramski is a contributor to The Nation, founder of The Voices of Poverty, author of 7 books, including his most recent, The House of 20,000 Books. Sasha, before we get to phone calls, I wonder what your thoughts are about the electorate being the most racially and ethnically diverse ever. This is according to Pew Research. What do you think if we step away from party politics? What kind of changes are we going to see?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the country itself is as diverse or maybe more diverse as it's ever been. The culture is getting more diverse by the year. Our cuisine is getting more diverse. Our religions are getting more diverse. Our languages are getting more diverse. And that's a wonderful thing, but it's creating a backlash. And I think what we're seeing here in many ways is the last stand of a conservative segment of the country that is absolutely terrified of ethnic and cultural change. And so when Trump's been going around the country saying, "I'm your last chance," for that group of voters, he's actually not wrong. That this election is probably the last time that conservative white voters will be able to hold a critical sway when it comes to voting, and that every year from here on out we're going to see a more diverse electorate. And what that means is states like Arizona and Texas, that for years and years and years have been reliably Republican, the next few election cycles they're going to start turning purple, and then a few election cycles after that there's a pretty good chance that even Texas will start turning blue again.
Well, we've got a number of listeners who'd like to weigh in on this. Let's hear from Marga in Oakland. Hi, Marga. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for your program. It's the shining light in my radio life. This has gone on for a long time.
Thank you.
How can we go on? I think I would love students of journalism to look at who decides. You know the old thing, if it bleeds, it leads. Trump, as far as I could hear on NPR, my favorite news stations, led every broadcast. And there was no discussion of issues as there might have been when I first started in public radio in the 50s, of the issues, you know, homeless, all the things you talk about. Hmm. They are closed out for this personal sniping stuff, which makes me want to not vote for either of them. But I guess we've got to do something, huh?
Right. Well, I hope you voice your opinions to the media. You know, write emails, make phone calls. It's really important to express your views. Sasha, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, Marga has a point. You turn on the radio and it's sort of, this person likes Trump, this person likes Hillary, and it's a soundbite.
I think she's absolutely right. And I think the way much of the media has covered the last year has been a disgrace, because it has literally devolved politics into a reality show.
Yep.
And so, you know, when Marga was talking about the fact there's no room for a discussion of poverty or of homelessness or of climate change or any of these other critical issues, she's absolutely right that in the last year, what we've seen is the most powerful country on earth, the country whose every decision impacts people around the world, has decided for some bizarre reason that how it chooses its national leader will more closely resemble a reality TV show than a serious political process. And I think the question for all of us in the media is, A, what role did we have in this? You know, how do we facilitate this devolution of our political process? And then the question going forward is, how do we make amends so that next time around and the time after that, we actually have a serious policy discussion in the many, many, many months that we have an election campaign going on? Because if we do this again, if we go into 2020 and have yet another spectacle devoid of serious policy discussion, we're going to turn an entire generation off of politics. It's just a recipe for cynicism. Mm.
Well, and also the Washington Post has a really good story called $1 Billion Profit. Yes, the campaign has been a gusher for CNN. According to people familiar with CNN's finances, they're bringing in $1 billion in gross profit this year. Fox News, $1.67 billion. MSNBC, $279 million this year. I mean, massive profits for these networks.
Yeah, and I think what you see is the television has been the medium that has had a bonanza on this election cycle. And the newspapers, which were already in crisis, when you look at their numbers, you're seeing they're in even greater crisis, that fewer and fewer people are reading serious news journalism, and more people are getting their news from cable networks or just sort of from a grab bag of social media. And there's, you know, there's a real problem with that. And I teach journalism. I teach a lot of journalism classes at UC Davis. And even in my journalism classes, very few of my students read newspapers anymore. Mm. And when I ask them, you know, where do you get your news? They'll sort of get it on trending sites, on Facebook, on Instagram, maybe some of these news aggregators. But they have no really coherent approach to news gathering. So they consume whatever's sent their way. And if what's sent their way is spectacle instead of serious news, then they have no choice but to absorb the spectacle.
Eileen, what are your thoughts on this? Media coverage and how we move forward. I mean, people are just very frustrated with the media this election cycle.
They're totally right to feel that way. I mean, I agree. We didn't hear during all these months about the issues that we really should have been talking for months and months. I'm going to tell you specifically around the Latino community and the Latino issues. The thing about the wall in the border and the attacks on immigrants and the attacks on Mexicans took a lot of space in media. And at some point, it looked like for Latinos and Latino voters, the most important thing was to talk about issues related to immigration or issues related to the border. And at some point, we forgot that Latino voters are U.S. citizens, are people living in the U.S., many of them for many, many years, and they have the same concerns, the same fears, the same issues to solve than the rest of the U.S. citizens. According to Pew Research, the top issues in this election for the Latino registered voters were economy, healthcare, and education, just as the rest of the U.S. citizens. And yet, every time we talk about Latinos in media, we were talking about the wall in the border, and we were talking about Mexicans. So we forgot about what really is important for our audiences, and now we have to look forward. Any person who gets in the White House has to we have to start looking at them and asking them for the responses that maybe they didn't give us when they were candidates. Maybe because we didn't ask at the right moment to have that information available.
Well, thank you for calling in, Marga. Let's go to our next caller, Lisa, in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you again, Rose, for covering Standing Rock. I really, really appreciate that. I was also there. Now, one of the things that I wanted to reflect on was this complete lack of knowledge regarding American history and this fear of stepping outside of the two-party dominant system in safe states. There's this lack of knowledge that, in fact, the majority of the gains that have been gained by the working people and women's rights and voting rights and things like that have been gained by being willing to step outside the dominant political spectrum, outside of the dominant families that control this country, and have been able to present a very important front, a powerful front, which is something that can actually make change in this country. With respect to the media and things like that, it's also very important that that we realize the amount of money that is being poured into these elections by, and how our candidates are being basically bought off by these major corporations. It's not a coincidence that climate change was not even mentioned once during the debates. That's not a coincidence. You know, the fossil fuel industry has pretty much control this election so far.
Well, you bring up a good point about money and politics, and we're definitely going to talk about that during tonight's live broadcast at the Roxy. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, this election could top $6.6 billion. Hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on propositions here in California. And then even at the local level, we are breaking records. So Sasha, you know, bringing up money in politics is also related to the coverage that we're getting.
I think so. And, you know, we're living in the Citizens United era, which means that a system that was always dominated by big money is now even more dominated by big money. And we're seeing just here in California, for example, in the propositions, just vast amounts of money being thrown by the pharmacy company, for example, against Proposition 61. There's just so much money in our political process that it does in some ways make it very, very difficult to talk about real issues or to talk about real issues in a serious way. Now, when Lisa was talking about the fact that, you know, most progressive changes in this country have come from the bottom up through grassroots struggle, she's absolutely right. And you see that with trade unions, for example, that, you know, the reason that workers in the middle part of the 20th century were able to earn decent wages was because their parents a generation earlier and their grandparents two generations before them had fought for union representation. And one of the things we've seen in the last 30 years is a concerted effort by big money to destroy trade unions, and not just unions, but trade union political culture. And one of the things that happens when you destroy collective bargaining rights and you destroy political participation at the bottom of the economy, you create great economic uncertainty. You create all the conditions for an economic collapse at the bottom of the economy. And people, when they feel that they're being attacked economically and when they have no progressive political structures in place to channel their anger, tend toward demagogy. Not all the time, but often. And I think that's one of the stories. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about white working class voters turning toward Trump. Well, one of the reasons they're turning toward Trump is because the Republican Party in particular, but not just the Republican Party, has spent the last 35 to 40 years destroying trade union culture. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to rebuild that, and we have to rebuild all of the grassroots progressive activism that has created change over the decades, because unless we rebuild it, we're ceding all of that ground to conservatives and to demagogues.
Sasha Abramski is a contributor to The Nation, founder of The Voices of Poverty, and the author of many books, including The House of 20,000 Books. We're also joined by Eileen Truax, a journalist who covers immigration and the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Eileen is the author of Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream, and her forthcoming book, out next year, is about the exile and asylum process from Mexico to the United States. And if you'd like to join us today, if you'd like to share your reflections on this election season, on election day, we'd love to hear from you. What does the 2016 election reveal about the state of our country and the media? And then how do you think we should move forward? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Thomas who says, although I am voting for Hillary Clinton this time around, there's part of me that feels the country needs to hold up a mirror and see who we are at this point in time. Maybe we'd see that we need to correct ourselves. If Donald Trump were to win, I believe we would bottom out, and thus a lot of laws, protocols, bills would be generated by a country that would finally admit we are divided like never before and we need to cross aisles and get things done. Joe writes, there's no firewall between our larger culture and our political culture. If we'd been paying more attention to the acceptance and growth of the offensive outrageousness that constitutes the vast majority of reality TV, we might have been less surprised by the rise of Trump. I don't think we can understand this moment by limiting our discussion to the political. A degraded level of discourse has become accepted across American society. Eileen, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, of course. I think it is the moment to see ourselves, and we have to start thinking about what's going to happen starting tomorrow. We're going to need a very hard, careful reconciliation process in this country. And of course, yes, we have to take a look at ourselves and start correcting ourselves. Something that catches my attention and makes me think about this is that comparing with 2008 with the Obama effect, where everyone was so energized about the candidate, people were feeling hope about the times to come. They were voting for the candidate. In this occasion, many of the people are not voting for a candidate, but against a candidate. That's happening with people voting for Trump because they don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, and the other way around. People who are voting for Hillary because they don't want Trump getting to the White House. So voting against someone instead of voting for the candidate that you want, it's a very bad signal at this moment. And I think this also can help to explain what happened with the Latino vote. Many Latino people are voting against Trump, against the possibility, not because they feel they're going to gain something, because they're going to have something better for the future. It's just to protect what they already have, to not get a worse future, to reduce the possibility of things going worse. So when you get to an election with this move, and when you have a president that arrived to the White House among these conditions, I think the process is going to be hard, and we as a society have to start thinking, how are we going to do this reconciliation process? Because, you know, among neighbors, among families, you have seen these very bitter arguments that we have to start overcoming soon.
And also, Eileen, what stories have you heard among people you've interviewed about how they've been affected by this? I remember hearing one story, I believe it was on NPR, about how in a classroom of young students, the white students surrounded the students of color and said they wanted to build a wall. I mean, this is affecting so many different populations across the country.
No, but of course, you know, we know that every election, immigrants traditionally became the scapegoat. When you have electoral processes or when you have economic crisis, immigration is always, you know, that scapegoat that is there just to pass the blame on. But in this particular case, because we have had so much media coverage on every phrase that Trump said, on every way to mock certain communities, this is reflecting, especially, you know, in our children. Mm. We have children in our communities, you know, children who are immigrant or children who are U.S. citizens who are part of immigrant families being told, go back to your country. You do not belong here. Mm. So that's what we created with this election. A few minutes ago, Sasha was talking about the next time around. Oh, God. I don't even want to talk about the next election, but yes, let's start thinking about it. Let's learn from this one, and let's start working for this to not be repeated in the future, please. Mm.
Well, we have time for just a few more calls. Let's hear from Ed in San Francisco. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how do you do? I had a couple comments. One was I was doing a sort of my own poll on CNN, and they had Trump at least 3 or 4 to 1. I mean, just the amount of time they gave to Trump. So everything that turns out bad on Trump, he had a chance to answer. Just massive coverage. I believe CNN and these news people basically created this guy from simply the other. And the other thing is the man was talking about trade unions. I think these people have set out to deliberately destroy the laws that protected workers before, and the possibility of the laws. The main difficulty you've got now are so many people on these independent contracts.
Yep.
Which make it virtually impossible to organize, and not even to think about organizing.
Yeah,
so that's the thing to overcome.
Well, thank you. We've done so many shows about that and privatization, and I'm not sure if you heard me reference this Washington Post story earlier, Ed, but according to people intimately familiar with CNN's finances, its gross profit this year will approach $1 billion, a milestone unseen in its 36-year history. And you can watch a panel of 10 people talk about the election over the course of an hour and really learn nothing. So, but these networks are bringing in a lot of money because what's interesting is in the Bay Area, I mean, I don't have a TV, so I can't say this for sure, but you don't often see Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump ads in San Francisco. But when I was in Bismarck, North Dakota, oh, they were everywhere. I mean, every other second was a mostly Hillary Clinton ad. And they have to spend a lot of money on those ads, and they go to the networks. So, once again, you have to follow the money. Thank you for calling in, Ed. Let's go next to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to reflect a little bit about the Electoral College, about elimination of Bernie Sanders through a lot of dirty tricks, and what we can do about it. The Electoral College is a winner-take-all system, state by state. And I think what I agree with every single thing that's been said on this show strongly. But I think what we can do about this, undemocratic system, is at least in the states where, the goal is we must not have Trump. So in order not to have Trump, we're going to probably end up with Hillary. But if you are in a solidly red or blue state with a big spread and you're going to get a certain candidate, you might as well vote for Jill Stein. Because Jill Stein, if you vote for her, it'll help the Green Party help them toward getting federal funding next time.
She needs about 5%, right, nationwide for that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for calling in, and we'll definitely bring up those numbers tomorrow. And let's end with Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hopefully by tonight this pathetic thing will be over. I just a couple of comments. One, I mean, this, I hate to say this, but this is the state of the country. I mean, the election is just a representation, I think, of the state of the country. I listened to some Trump supporters. It was really amazing to listen to sort of the lack of information and facts. But beyond that, it's hard to imagine. And your other callers have mentioned this, that climate change didn't get front and center and talked about with the kind of urgency that it needs to be talked about. So, I mean, that, if that were the only thing that was a problem, it would be a serious problem. You asked about how to move forward. I think people in states are going to have to take a hard look at trying to change their states. You may not be able to do anything on the national level. You can try, but you're going to have to try at the state level. And finally, I want to just say this. I think at this point, I don't know if this can happen.
Greg, sorry, I got to cut you off because we have only a minute left, and we've done a lot of shows about power at the state level. I just want to end with Greg's question. What are your thoughts on moving forward? How should we move forward? Sasha?
I think he's right. We've got to put a lot of effort in at the state level where there are going to be some very progressive changes going through today. We've also got to put a lot of effort into educating voters politically about what's real and what's fantasy. And unless we do that, we're going to have these sort of fact-free elections where you can say anything, and as long as you say it with enough bluster, people are going to believe you. And I think that's absolutely critical as we move forward.
Eileen, what are your thoughts?
Regarding the Latino community, I just expect that all the fuss that we have around the Latino vote and the Latino community right now keeps going on in the next month and the next year. Immigrants are still here. Latinos are still here. We are part of this community. We have health issues, education issues. We have job concerns, economy concerns, just like the rest of the U.S. citizens. And we are giving to these communities, just like the rest of the U.S. citizens. We are here, and we are part of a community, not an isolated pocket of the country. So I hope we can start seeing the Latino community in a more comprehensive way.
Eileen Truax is a freelance journalist covering immigration. She's the author of Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Sasha Abramski is a contributor to The Nation and the author of many books, including The House of 20,000 Books. Sasha and Eileen, thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Well, thank you. Happy Election Day. I hope you get out and vote. The polls are open until 8 o'clock tonight. And find election information if you still have some homework to do at kalw.org. And I hope you can join us for our live election night event. We will have independent analysis from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Roxy. And it'll end with a group hug because I think we all need one. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, what's next after Election Day? After enduring months of nonstop election coverage, it's finally over. What happens next is up to us. From climate change to racial justice, grassroots movements have pushed issues to the forefront of the national stage. Concerned citizens are moving lawmakers and corporations to change their policies and their practices. So what is the most effective way to hold the powerful accountable beyond the elections? Join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.